Throughout the summer, we are inviting the major candidates who are officially running for governor to make their case to you. Earlier this month, we spoke to Republican candidate and former state representative Jeff Diehl and Democratic candidate and state senator Sonia Chang Diaz. You can find those conversations on our website, radioboston.org. Today, we welcome former state senator Ben Downing, who is running to be the Democratic candidate for governor. Senator Downing, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with a question that I have asked every candidate who's joined us. That is, what makes you now in 2021 better than anyone else to be governor now and to run the Commonwealth?
So first, I bring a statewide perspective and coalition to the race. I grew up in Pittsfield, represented that community and 51 other communities in Western Massachusetts. I know the unique challenges and opportunities that our gateway cities and the rural regions of this state face. But I've also raised a family for the last 4 years here in East Boston and know the challenges that this immigrant community deals with every single day around housing, around transportation, and any number of other issues. And I think to be an effective governor, you need to be able to see both those perspectives, bring them together, and be able to tap into the potential that exists in all 351 cities and towns in this Massachusetts.
So key to many parts of your platform, like funding childcare, reducing income inequality, is taxing higher earners. The millionaire's tax appears to be going before voters in 2022. Do you think a millionaire's tax is the best way to fight income inequality, and why?
Yes, it is. We can ask those who have benefited from economic growth over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 20 years. We can ask them to pay more to make the investments we need to make in universal childcare, in transportation, in housing, in education, to have debt-free higher education. It's the least we can ask of those who have benefited even during the COVID pandemic recession. So yes, I support the millionaire's tax. I've voted for it in the past. And above and beyond that, I'll also be rolling out my own comprehensive tax plan if that were to not move forward, because these are investments we need to make to address economic fairness, racial justice.
How do you successfully make that case to the millionaires, or do you just work around them and get it passed without them?
I think you need to be willing to listen to everyone, but I think it's fairly obvious that when we are talking about rampant economic inequality in every corner of Massachusetts, what you see is that the state government has failed to make the investments that we need to make in our communities to be able to address that. And that has come at a time where we have cut taxes in a way that has disproportionately benefited the wealthiest for the better part of the last three decades. This is about getting back to what we used to do to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. There's simple steps that we can take. We can listen to everyone. But when all is said and done, we need to fight for people who've been my neighbors, who I represented in the Senate, folks in communities that for too long have been an afterthought, for too long have been forgotten, those who suffer when we kick the can down the road at the state.
So you made an allusion a minute ago to other tax policies that could be put in place if this doesn't pass. But just there, you made a pretty strong case that this is the equitable way to do it. So who and what are you going to tax to fund these programs if the millionaire's tax doesn't pass?
I think you need to put everything on the table when it comes to existing economic development incentives, loopholes in our existing structure. You need to be able to look at every single tax in a comprehensive way and say, who is paying for it and how do we make sure that we fund the public services that we need? For too long in Massachusetts, we've fought about this tax hike or that tax cut, and we haven't had the broader discussion about what are the public goods that we need to fund. And that is how you end up in a broader community here in Massachusetts with massive economic inequality, with regional inequity that leaves behind the communities that I've called home in Western and Central Massachusetts, that leaves behind my neighbors here in East Boston.
All right. I want to talk about progressive voice in this race. Senator Downing, you're running against at least two other Democratic candidates that would call themselves progressives. Do you call yourself a progressive, and what sets you apart from the other candidates?
Yeah. So first, I got into this race long before there were any other candidates in it. We announced in February because I thought the need for a more urgent sense of leadership was critical in this. So yes, I believe I am a progressive. I have a voting record that is a progressive record from my time in office, and have partnered with progressive allies in the State House and outside of the State House to try to bring about the change we need in our communities. And I think the unique aspect that I bring to that is that I have been a climate leader and a climate leader who is focused on equity from day one. I have worked and led on climate issues throughout my entire public career. I'm also a leader who folks can trust. I made a promise that I would term limit myself my first election in 2006 and kept to that. And when I left, I didn't take some lobbying job. I didn't take some government relations job. I joined a clean energy leader and I said, I want to be a part of the transition to a just, a fair, and a sustainable tomorrow for everyone. So I think I'm uniquely positioned as a progressive in this race to help us make the urgent transition we need to away from fossil fuels to a clean energy economy that benefits everyone.
So you went to the private sector, you stuck with your promise to term and limit yourself, but that also took you out of the public eye. In 2016, you were in the private sector. Now you've got opponents on the Democratic side. State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz is a current elected official, a prominent voice in legislative battles on things like education and police reform. You've got Danielle Allen, a highly visible Harvard professor and author. Name recognition is an issue, and it's going to be hard to win this race without it. How are you going to grow your name recognition back in the public eye?
So a couple of things. First, I think the perspective that I got being away from Beacon Hill, stepping outside of the bubble that too often defines debate at the statehouse, is a valuable thing. It has allowed me to realize just how small our ambitions are too often at the statehouse. And the work I did outside of Massachusetts showed me what other states were doing with far less by way of resources. So first, I think I bring a unique perspective in that regard. Along with that, you know, I'm going to be able to achieve the name recognition we need the only way that you can, the only way that I know how, which is campaigning day and night across the 351 cities and towns of Massachusetts. We've already done 70 plus Democratic town committees and caucuses. We're out there meeting with folks every single day in communities that too often have been an afterthought, too often have been left behind. And I think we have a resilient coalition in Western Massachusetts, in our gateway cities, in and among climate voters. That's our path to victory, both in the primary and the general election. And it's one that I'm excited about knitting together.
So that's a really retail politics strategy on the ground, door to door. You have talked with pride about being sort of an outsider who won the first time you ran, youngest state senator in the Commonwealth. You know, out there in the fall, there is the question of whether Attorney General Maura Healey will join the Democratic primary. And that, I mean, if she does, that just changes the race. Does the door to door approach hold in that case, or will you have to take a different strategy?
Our approach and our strategy is our strategy, regardless of who's in the field, regardless of if the attorney general, my friend, gets into the race or not, regardless of if Governor Baker runs again. That's why I got in February. That was our strategy from the beginning. And I think that's a type of politics that, especially after the last year plus, people are hungry for. We want to be able to come together to take on big things. We've been told for too long by our leaders that we are incapable of addressing the challenges that we see every day in our communities. And I know from my experience outside of the statehouse that if we are able to tap into the potential, able to tap in to the energy, the talents in our communities, then the future of Massachusetts is limitless. What we're missing is that urgent form of leadership. So we're going to run an urgent campaign that models the type of leadership we want to bring to the statehouse.
You just talked about the big things, right? The big systemic things and how important they are after the last year. And I do get that. It's been one heck of a 16 or 17 months. But I am also mindful that Governor Baker has had, and we don't know if he's running, but that part isn't necessary to the question I'm going to ask you now. He has had near stratospheric popularity at times as a governor who's known as a day-to-day manager. And I also think of the late Boston Mayor Tom Menino, elected to 5 terms, known as an urban mechanic. And I wonder how you bridge the big issues, the systemic structural stuff, with what may be a voter base that looks like it likes day-to-day management, more potholes and playgrounds than wealth inequality.
Yeah, so I think you find a way to bridge the two, right? And when we talk about climate action, we're talking about actually rebuilding our transportation system. So instead of being an embarrassment and something that holds us back, it's the envy of the world. We need to have a strong, robust, reliable transit system if we're actually going to be able to combat climate change. And hey, by the way, doing that, is also an issue of racial and economic justice and regional equity. So we find a way to connect those broader issues with the experiences that folks see in their day-to-day lives. And I think it's critically important that as Democrats, especially if Governor Baker runs, we don't just say, well, Charlie Baker's a Republican, you don't like national Republicans, don't vote for them. But rather, we point out what we would do if we earn voters' trust and have the responsibility and the honor of putting together a government, of running an administration. And also, we point out the shortcomings of this administration. I think too often, Governor Baker has benefited from the bar being set too low, right? We're going to make sure to point out the shortcomings of Governor Baker's record and point out what we would do if we're lucky enough to earn voters' trust over the course of this campaign.
So you've brought him into the mix now in this conversation. You told WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks that you believe the governor is, quote, a good man and a dedicated public servant, end quote. What has his administration done wrong, and what kind of grade would you give him for the coronavirus pandemic?
So Governor Baker, when it comes to sort of generally what Governor Baker has done wrong, I don't think he's had the sense of urgency to be able to address the big challenge in front of us. Too often, the governor has had to be pulled along on climate. When I wrote the law that created the offshore wind industry, that wasn't a priority for the Baker administration. They had to be pulled along ultimately to sign up for that. On the Roe Act, when we know that the fundamental rights of women across Massachusetts are being challenged by conservative justices at the federal level, the governor had to be pulled along to sign on to that. On any number of key pieces of legislation, the governor is not out front leading, but rather we have to expend energy to pull him along. When it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine response, I think on communication, too often the communication to local communities and local providers has been one way, and they have not feel like their concerns and their expertise has been heard. When it comes to the vaccine rollout, I think Governor Baker scrapped the 20-year playbook that the Department of Public Health and local boards of health had established. We should have had centralized pre-registration from the beginning. That would have allowed for greater partnerships and a greater focus on equity from the beginning. That would have allowed us to get some of the hesitancy we're dealing with right now.
So if you were governor tomorrow, what is the first change you would make in the state's COVID strategy or COVID policy?
The first change that I would make in the state's COVID strategy and the state's COVID policy would be to actually have an open line of communication, especially with the K-12 system. You know, we're now about 4 weeks out at most from schools reopening, and I know there is a great deal of confusion. The governor and his administration have not been out front and communicating with, in particular, the K-12 public school systems around what the expectations are going to be, around the data from which they are measuring on that. I think that is the most important unknown at this point, along with deeper partnerships with local community coalitions, community-based organizations, not just to run vaccine-focused events, but rather to partner in existing community events that people are hungry to get to, and to figure out how we can wrap in the vaccine rollout to those efforts.
So last question for you. You've talked about being a progressive. This is a state that tends to like a split governance, right? Republicans in the governor's mansion and a Democratic state and state house. How do you pick up voters in the general election running as a progressive?
I think the most important thing is that we remember we have to earn voters' trust. I think voters rightly look at the state house and they say, there's a lot of Democrats up there. If I put a Democrat in the corner office, what's going to happen? We are being specific, and I am being specific, about the type of campaign that we're running. We're not taking donations from lobbyists, from PACs, or from fossil fuel interests to show voters that they can be confident in trusting me and in trusting the administration that we will build. Just like they can be confident because of the fact that I made a promise I would term limit myself and held to that over time. We're going to continue to run a campaign that voters, Democrats, independents, and even some Republicans are going to look at and say, we might not agree with everything that Ben Downing says, but I know as governor, I'll be able to trust him and that he will act with the best interest of the public in mind. So we will put trust first and foremost. That's how Democrats win. We've got to give our base something to come out for, and we've got to be able to earn their trust.
Former State Senator Ben Downing, who's running to be the Democratic candidate for governor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.